I'm going to be abusing all of you this morning because if you look at the screen as we've been studying the life of Christ now for quite a few months, this is, you know, a photograph. Whoa, what was that? It's his fault. I did nothing. Not sure what happened there, but we've been having some trouble with frequencies, I know, and various things. So still working out the bugs in the new microphone system. But what this is some actors attempting to depict John chapter 5, which I'm inviting you all please to turn to now. Because in John chapter 5, you have the first time of quite a few in which the Gospels portray Jesus speaking of and interacting with the old Jewish Sabbath. And so we'll have but one lesson here this morning as we're studying the life of Christ, try to collect quite a few of these events from the Gospels where Jesus is teaching about the Sabbath, which only the Jews were responsible to keep, and only during the time of the Old Testament. This John chapter 5 takes place, if you've turned there now, it says, after these things, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. There is in Jerusalem by the sheep gate. Now, there are some seven gates that go through the walls into the old city of Jerusalem. One of these was called the sheep gate, apparently because it was very close to an access to the Temple Mount itself where these sheep would be sacrificed. And so the shepherds would bring the sheep in for the sacrifice through this one gate that was closest then to the temple area itself. But it says, in Jerusalem by the sheep gate, a pool, which is called in Hebrew Bethesda, having five porticos. Now, if you'll direct your attention to the screen again, this is that very large model of Jerusalem that's in the Jerusalem Museum. I've been showing you quite a few pictures of this through the last several months, and this one, though, I think is the largest, or farthest back that I've shown. So if you get something of the scale here, we have an adult standing right here. We have another young man apparently with a child on his shoulder and then another child following along behind. So you can see it's really a very, very large model that has been produced there. And this would represent the Kidron Valley right here that you read so much about Jesus and the apostles crossing. But this would be then the eastern wall of both the temple complex and the larger city of Jerusalem that was around it. So the Kidron Valley, the eastern side, this then would be the northern side, and these towers that had been built by the Romans when, in 64 BC, they had come into this territory, subjugated the Jews, and then built their military fortresses to continue to contain the Jews. The sheep gate, apparently, is this little archway that you see right here. And then you can see just a little bit here of what are the pools of Bethesda. So in this area, there was a large collection of water, an area to collect water. And then the sheep would come into this area. You can see it's immediately adjacent to the temple. It's thought that the preparations for the sacrifices and whatnot took place inside those walls. And so this is the area we're talking about. So on the northeastern corner of the city of Jerusalem, and immediately adjacent to the Temple Mount itself. Now, and I wanted to bring this up, though, because the Exodus movie is going to be talking about the archaeological and historical corroboration for the Bible. We've been doing quite a bit of that on Wednesday nights in recent classes as we've talked about Christian evidences or apologetics. And this pool of Bethesda, as we have now in artist construction, has been a source of argumentation where the skeptic, just like they do with the entire Exodus events, the whole book and all that's written in it, have done the same thing with the pool of Bethesda, said never existed, we haven't been able to find, you know, any remnants of it. Then they find some remnants of it, and they say, well, you know, we've got problems because there's only four porticos. One, two, three, and four. So the Bible's wrong again, you know, it says there's five porticos, and we've only found four. Now, guess what? they discovered that there were two immediately adjoining pools now, and that if you will renumber these walls, you will find that the one in the middle is number, guess what? It's number 5. And so what you have is open air, you know, because of the columns and then a roof above them, a portico in which an awfully large number of people apparently could gather. Now here is another model, a different model of this area again. So there's the temple itself. Here's the walls in for the Temple Mount. The sheep gate would be this room, you know, so right here in the wall, just outside the picture there. Here you can see some of the shepherds bringing their sheep in. And then you have this staircase coming up. It would be a divided pool with 5 porticos then, where the event of John chapter 5 will be taking place. This next photograph is of this same model, just has pulled back a little bit. Again, you see all the sheep that they put into the area there. I suspect that this appearance here is really very much smaller than it actually was. And so, you know, they do the best that they can, but the scale of the first century maybe not depicted very accurately there, but quite a few people could gather. And what we learned in modern times as well is they have excavated this area. I thought about bringing a picture of that. Ron and I have been there and took some pictures, but it's very difficult to actually kind of discern what you're looking at there because there's several layers of construction. But these pools were apparently very deep. I mean, on the order of like 30, 40, 50 feet deep. And so massive amounts of water could be collected there. And then they would build staircases could lead you down into this. But it was, you know, quite a pool, an abyssal almost kind of a pool, or massive amounts of water were stored there. So in John chapter 5, we have a story told about an actual event at that location. In verse 3, in these porticos lay a multitude of those who were sick, blind, lame, and withered, waiting for the moving of the waters. For an angel of the Lord went down at certain seasons into the pool and stirred up the water. Whoever then first, after the stirring up of the pool, stepped in, was made well from whatever disease with which he was afflicted. And a certain man was there who had been 38 years in his sickness. When Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he had already been a long time, he said to him, "Do you wish to get well?" The sick man answered him, "Sir, I have no man to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up. But while I am coming, another steps down before me." Jesus said to him, "Arise, take up your pallet, and walk." Immediately the man became well, took up his pallet, and began to walk. Now, it was the Sabbath on that day. Now there is, chronologically, the first appearance in the life of Christ of the Sabbath. How he will relate to that Sabbath and what he will teach us about that Sabbath, we must always remember, takes place while Jesus is a Jew teaching Jews how to be Jews under the old law. He will not die for 3 more years. Christianity will not be established. His kingdom is not being built up yet. It'll be 3 years before any of those events take place. But while Jesus was still perfecting himself, qualifying himself to be our sacrifice for sin, he must be sinless in order to be a sacrifice for sin, he had to keep every law in the Old Testament. And the first time that we see him keeping the law of the Sabbath is when he heals this man there at these pools of Bethesda. Now, just continuing the reading at verse 10. It took place on a Sabbath day. Therefore, the Jews were saying to him who was cured, "It is the Sabbath, and it is not permissible for you to carry your pallet." Now, please note, it's just amazing to me, Jesus, the master teacher, of course, knowing exactly what he's doing, how he gave 2 commands to that man. Take up your pallet and walk. Now, does that man need that pallet anymore? No. Nobody needs to be carrying him in there
so that he can then, you know, be failing at being able, you know, to get to the water. He doesn't need a bed, if that's what he's using the pallet for, to live there at the pool of Bethesda. I'm not sure which it is. But that pallet, very, very lightweight thing, used to lie upon and sometimes to carry people upon, he doesn't need there anymore. But Jesus commands him to pick it up because Jesus apparently is intending to create a stir, to make a scene, to call attention to himself and to focus attention on the Jews, their teachings and behavior, and an appropriate relationship to the Sabbath itself. And so he ordered the man to pick that up, and he ordered him to walk, and in so doing, has set up the circumstances for quite a confrontation, which will account for the entirety of the remaining part of chapter 5. All of chapter 5 is related to this event. All of the teaching that follows after we get just the physical circumstances springs forth from Jesus healing on the Sabbath and ordering a man to carry a burden, not much of one to be sure, but to carry a burden, if you will, on the Sabbath. So then, they're upset about it. Not permissible. We charge you with breaking the Sabbath. In verse 11, he answered them, "He who made me well was the one who said to me, 'Take up your pallet and walk.'" They asked him, "Who is the man who said to you, 'Take up your pallet and walk?'" But he who was healed did not know who it was, for Jesus had slipped away while there was a crowd in that place. Afterward, Jesus found him in the temple and said to him, "Behold, you have become well. Do not sin anymore, so that nothing worse may befall you." Just as an aside, remember, brethren, crippled for life, not so bad as committing a sin. Crippled for life is pretty bad. But a worse thing will befall you when you sin. The sin itself is worse. The punishment for the sin is worse. Let nothing worse come upon you than a lifetime of debilitating, you know, loss of your legs by committing a sin. Now then, in verse 15, the man went away and told the Jews that it was Jesus who had made him well. And for this reason, see how early it is in the life of Christ, the Jews were persecuting Jesus because he was doing these things on the Sabbath. But he answered them, "My Father is working until now, and I myself am working. For this cause, therefore, the Jews were seeking all the more to kill him, because he was not only breaking the Sabbath, remember by their lights and definition, but also was calling God his own Father, making himself equal with God." Any lessons to be learned in all of this? Only a few minutes to discuss it all, but it's to see, brethren, that perhaps we need to find some additional courage and try ourselves to acquire some notoriety, to stand out from all the rest of the crowd. What Jesus does here gathers the attention, really, that whole city, when you've got all of the religious leaders angry with him to the point of wanting to both persecute and to kill him. Jesus is serious about teaching the truth. While he lived under the old law, and as he will be creating for us a new relationship with our God, a new covenant, Jesus was all about making a splash in that community so that people would hear about it, so that they would know about it. Now, I'm just going to skip a little bit through the remainder of the chapter. Let's read now 19 and following, just to see that some of the most sublime things that Jesus ever taught, he taught in the face of enemies. He taught in the face of opposition. He taught in the face of persecution and even murder plots. He taught these things because he chose to demonstrate in his life the truth and then to teach about it to those and for those who both violently opposed that truth, as well as those, of course, who had the open heart willing to receive it. Verse 19, Jesus therefore answered,
and was saying to them. Twice we've been told about the persecution, wanting to kill him. He therefore was saying to them, truly, truly, I say to you, the Son can do nothing of himself unless it is something he sees the Father doing. Whatever the Father does, these things the Son also does in like manner. For the Father loves the Son and shows him all things that he himself is doing. And greater works than these will he show him, that you may marvel. For just as the Father raises the dead and gives them life, even so the Son also gives life to whom he wishes. For not even the Father judges anyone, but he has given all judgment to the Son, in order that all may honor the Son, even as they honor the Father. He who does not honor the Son does not honor the Father who sent him. Truly, truly I say to you, he who hears my word and believes him who sent me has eternal life and does not come into judgment, but has passed out of death into life. Now, brethren, them's fighting words. Okay. They already wanted to kill him. They were already trying to hunt him down. And he is only beginning his work. Jesus has laid down the gauntlet, drawn that line in the sand, and made a name for himself that he will stand for the truth. And as I've said, some of these most sublime teachings that we can imagine, beginning with the declaration that he is now one with the Father and doing the work of the Father, is absolutely infuriating to these religious leaders. Fear not to infuriate the religious establishment, so long as you are practicing the truth. And then it will give you opportunity to teach some of the doctrines we've already seen, but now skipping to verse 28, doctrines like this. Do not marvel at this. And he's still talking about resurrection and eternal life. An hour is coming in which all who are in the tombs shall hear his voice and shall come forth, those who did the good deeds to a resurrection of life, those who committed the evil deeds to a resurrection of judgment. These profound teachings about eternal life and judgment and Jesus' relationship with the Father and his equality with the Father all arose because of his violation of the Jewish view of the Sabbath. Certainly not Moses' view or God's view thereof. Verse 36, the witness which I have is greater than that of John. He's speaking of the baptizer now. For the works which the Father has given me to accomplish, the very works that I do, bear witness of me that the Father has sent me. Now he references his miracles and declares, God sent me. And we'll conclude this chapter now with verse 45 and following. Do not think that I will accuse you before the Father. The one who accuses you is Moses, in whom you have set your hope. For if you believed Moses, you would believe me, for he wrote of me. But if you do not believe his writings, how will you believe my words? Now, brethren, talk about fighting words. He has just stood in the face of these Pharisees and other religious leaders and said to them, in so many words, you do not read, understand, or believe Moses. Who is, of course, the only people that they think they believe in, whom they study, and who they are trying to teach and to follow. This is as blatant, just a slap across the face, as Jesus could possibly offer to these men. And he is doing so, brethren, apparently, in the presence of multitudes, having just worked the miracle of healing this man, and now proclaiming himself equal with the Father, descended from heaven in the Father's need to do his will, proven by the miracles, with the power to raise the dead, and responsible for the final judgment, he himself being the judge. That is a lot to believe. And it all stems from this single event in John chapter 5. Now, I may have mentioned it in other classes. I want to bring this up and talk about it if I can, really. I'm holding before you a book that's so precious to me that I've had it rebound in great expense and leather and all of that. This is what it looked like on the left when I originally bought it. It's called A Harmony of the Gospels by Robert L. Thomas and Stanley N. Gundry. Thomas is the last name of one, and Gundry is the last name of the other. I highly and very much preferentially recommend the New American Standard version of this, though you can get it in the New International. The New International is not a very good study Bible. It comes pretty close to being a paraphrase. It's not one you want to use, you know, to really get to the meat of what the Gospels actually say. So get the New American Standard version. The Harmony of the Gospels by these two men, Thomas and Gundry, is maybe next to my Bible the most precious book I have in my library, because it allows me to see, gathered together on one page in parallel columns, the three gospel writers, in this case, that speak of the same event. They've arranged the life of Christ in the the chronological order, and then they put it, you know, in parallel columns so that you can see all the little variances, which are additional information to put together to get the whole story. And what you'll find, for instance, leaping off the page when you read the gospel like this, is that the next event in the life of Christ, after John 5, and the hatred he has produced by publicly opposing their teachings on the Sabbath, working a miracle on the Sabbath, telling the man to carry his talent on the Sabbath, and then all the teachings that came after that. Immediately after that, the next thing you read about in the life of Christ is also a Sabbath event, as will be the one after that. So John is the only gospel writer who tells us about the pools of Bethesda healing. He is not a synoptic gospel author, the seen together authors, who are Matthew, Mark, and Luke. They frequently will tell the same story among them. John often gives us different material. John's the only one who tells us about the pools of Bethesda. But in all four gospels, one of the very first things that happens in Jesus' life is the story of him and the Sabbath and the controversy that it produces. And then in the chronological order, we go instantly and immediately from the Sabbath where he healed that man to the Sabbath that you can read about in these passages. Matthew 12, Mark 2, and Luke 6. Now, as a matter of fact, for those note takers among us, it's I've given you the three passages now, but they speak of two events that follow immediately after John 5. Two more Sabbath events are found in those verses. I want to talk about those for just a minute, so please turn over to Matthew chapter 12. And while you're turning to Matthew chapter 12, it speaks of an event in which Jesus and the apostles are walking through green fields. Now, this man you see in the photograph is standing in front of fields that are ripe unto harvest at Endor. That's Mount Tabor, is how it's pronounced in the background. They've already done one row of plowing there in preparation for a future harvest. And so you can see how tall that the grain is, and you can imagine yourself now walking through that field and how readily the grain would come to hand. And then they would rub it, we are told, by putting all three Gospels together, they were rubbing it between their hands, which the Jews would accuse them of work now, violating the Sabbath, and then they were eating the kernels. In Matthew chapter 12, at verses 1 and 2, you have the setting of the stage for the immediately following event after John 5. Matthew 12, verse 1. At that time, Jesus went on the Sabbath through the grain fields, and his disciples became hungry and began to pick the heads and eat. But when the Pharisees saw it, they said to him, "Behold, your disciples do what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath." But he said to them, have you not read what David did when he became hungry, he and his companions, how he entered the house of God and they ate the consecrated bread, which was not lawful for him to eat, nor for those with him, but for the priests alone. Now again, brethren, when you say to a Pharisee, have you not read, that is an insult. It's a way of saying, you are utterly ignorant, aren't you? You haven't even read it, have you? They devoted their lives to reading about it. They knew all about it, they thought, but they also had a problem here. They are the great defenders of the Sabbath now. Well, all right. Then he challenges them, explain to me how David can go in and eat consecrated bread. Of course, they've got no answer for this. Did David break the law when it was a matter of life and death? No. Laws are designed for normal circumstances, and no law ought to cause death. Jesus now is hungry as they were hungry. They need their strength to fulfill God's mission for them. David did a thing that the law itself was saying was wrong. No law says that you can't walk through a field eating grain on a Sabbath day. That was a Pharisaic addition to the law. Jesus countered their false teaching with an actual event that they should have viewed as far worse, yet certainly they would never condemn David. God's law here, we learn from our Lord, is not a thing intended to destroy life. It is intended to manage life, to control life, to prevent sin, but not to kill you. Then, in verses 5 and 6, Jesus continues in the same vein, or have you not read in the law that on the Sabbath the priests in the temple break the Sabbath and are innocent? But I say to you, something greater than the temple is here. Now, how would a priest break the Sabbath in the temple? I don't know last time you wrestled with sheep or cattle, but if you want to take one in hand, cut its throat, carve it up, and offer it as a burnt sacrifice, guarantee you're going to break a sweat. In the first place, the animal's going to have something to say about it. In the second place, that's heavy. Those priests worked hard when they offered those sacrifices on the Sabbath. And Jesus has them by the throat yet one more time, doesn't he? You men don't read the law, you don't understand the law, you have no idea what you're talking about. And you are using the law to impose rules and regulations on people that would be such an unnecessary hardship as perhaps even to lead to the loss of their lives. This the law never did. And so again, it's humiliating them very publicly as he teaches them how to understand and properly practice the law. And we come to verse 7 in Matthew chapter 12. If you had known what this means, I desire compassion and not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the innocent. You also don't understand the passages and don't mention the Sabbath at all. This particular passage in Hosea, you likewise do not understand there in chapter 6, verse 6. You lack the compassion, which was a factor in God's creation of the law to begin with. Hosea understood that compassion is not a way to break the law. The law must always be kept. The law must never be kept to the exclusion of its intended purposes, which were for man and regarding compassion. This brings us, of course, to verse 8. The Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. I know what I'm talking about, Jesus says. I know how to behave on the Sabbath, and you don't. And I'm telling you right now, it is not a sin to heal. It is not a sin to carry that pallet.
It is not a sin to walk through these fields. It is not a sin to rub that grain, as you'll find in Mark, between your hands while you eat. I'm right. You're wrong. I'm the Lord. I ought to know.
Now comes Matthew, back to chapter 12. Whoop, did I get the wrong passage there? I did, I think. What did I do here? Matthew 12, in verse 9. I'm sorry. Departing from there, forgot my own introduction. It's the next event. He went into their synagogue, and behold, there was a man with a withered hand. They questioned him, saying, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? Brethren, has he taught on that already? First time we ever see him working with the Sabbath. Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? Why'd they ask him that question at the end of verse 10? It tells you. They wanted to trap him. Now in verse 11, I guess I didn't get my reveal going properly. In verse 11 he said to them, what man shall there be among you who shall have one sheep, and if it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will he not take hold of it and lift it out? Of how much more value then is a man than a sheep? So then, it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath. And in verses 13 and 14, he said to the man, stretch out your hand. And he stretched it out, and it was restored to normal like the other. But the Pharisees went out and counseled together against him as to how they might destroy him. This lesson, brethren, is a really easy one. It is Jesus marching fearlessly through a world of opposition that would both persecute and murder him, to stand as a light to the world and say, I will both teach and practice the truth no matter what anybody of great power says. And I am here to tell you that I am Lord of the Sabbath. I am sent by the Father. I am equal to Him. I can raise the dead, and you know I can, because you will see me do it. This is awfully early in His ministry. He will do this. He will raise people from the dead, and He will be their judge in the end. This Lord of the Sabbath was not breaking it. He was not violating it. He was keeping it. He was breaking and violating false teachings that had been heaped upon it. He is a Lord of the Sabbath, who understood in another passage that the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. What Jesus does for us, brethren, is twofold. There's a doctrinal side. The Sabbath will be done away entirely. No man must keep it now. This Lord of the Sabbath, having fulfilled its requisite rest and the types and the anti-types that were set up by it, is fulfilling it and abolishing it. But the other thing, brethren, we learn is about courage. It's about determination. Is about the importance of the gospel and the spread of that message, and how we must be dauntless in the face of any opposition, and using that opposition so that more people might hear about us, what we teach, and what we practice. May we learn in the Sabbath experiences of the Lord, brethren, to be absolutely fearless in the proclamation of the gospel. There'll be much more to come on Sabbath, come on Wednesday nights, come, I hope, and see the debate. We'll get into the intricacies of all of this. But for this morning, brethren, go out and do likewise. Now, if we can help you in that endeavor, if you're ready to become a Christian this morning, if you have a prayer request or a desire to study privately, personally, let me know. As always, we offer the invitation as we stand and sing.